It's time for another episode of the award-winning Webcomics Weekly.
Which awards did we win?
Thanks, by the way, for Brad's mom for giving us that award.
Thank you. I knew someone would run with it. Joining us today is our regular panel, despite our attempts to get some guests on here today. All the way from Los Angeles, it's Dave Kellett.
Can't say I didn't do it.
SheldonComics.com. Via the power of Skype and the Intertrons, hailing from Philly, it's Brad. What was your middle name for him, Chris?
Which one?
The one on the
Chortles
wigwam. It's Brad Geiger, evil-comic.com. You know a little thing?
What's that?
You got anything
like
for us?
We're stealing each other's taglines here. This is good.
Oh, man. I thought that was Dave.
You don't have a tagline?
Hey, oh, I was stealing hail.
Oh.
I stole Scott's. He stole mine. That's
all right. And now, sitting across from me, those loving brown eyes, Christopher Straub, StarslipCrisis.com.
Oh, who's a hungry baby?
What?
And across the desk from me is Scott Hammerin, Hank Kurtz of PvPOnline.com.
I thought I saw a pudding tat. What? I don't know. I got nothing this morning. I'm in a bad way.
Well, that means we need to go straight to the mailbag.
Straight to the mailbag. No.
Straight to the mailbag after that.
I have to begin with a correction from last week's Webcomics Weekly. Or did I do this already?
Don't remember. What was it?
We mentioned the program GIMP as a possible replacement for Photoshop and then dismissed it because it was Linux only.
Oh, I don't think we corrected this.
That is incorrect. GIMP is also for Windows. The proper reason to dismiss GIMP is because it sucks.
Yes, it looks bad.
Yeah, no, so on behalf of the 10,562 cartoonists using Photoshop for their cartooning, we apologize to the three that are using it with GIMP.
Yes. We did not mean to say that it is Linux only.
Why would they call it GIMP? It's like they're self-defeating. We know it's bad. We know you're not going to like it.
I actually had a friend over here in the came to visit the office two nights ago. We had dinner, and on his Mac, he had something called GIMP Shop. And it is essentially a port for GIMP that puts all of the Photoshop toolbars on it.
Oh, okay.
And so look for GIMP Shop. If you got to use the GIMP.
Don't use it the way they'd made it.
Don't, yeah. All right, so now that's corrected, let's move on with new stuff. Oh, where
all right, anybody want to start with a question?
Yeah, I would love to, but my machine is not booting, so go for it. Read them, Dave.
All right. Give me a voice to read it in, Chris.
Oh, okay. Do your British guy. Do your Lord Boffington.
Lord, all right. Let's talk about the direct market. I've been wondering if I've just been unlucky with the comic stores I've approached, or if there's some sort of disconnect between direct market vendors and the public. Every teacher and librarian I talk to is very enthusiastic about comics, but the store owners, who I assume would most benefit from getting new people into their stores, don't seem interested. Let me skip down to the question. None of them seem very interested in new stuff. I don't know. It surprised me that something that feels so exciting and newsworthy to me doesn't get celebrated all that much by the people who claim to be promoting the industry. Is this a sign of how the direct market culture thinks of comics versus the outside world? So basically the question is, what's wrong with the direct market? Why is it not work? And I think this is a valid question in light of the outlets for web cartoons in terms of distribution. Having forsaken or not forsaken, but having not using the print distribution channel of newspapers, we essentially distribute online, and then a lot of folks then print and try to distribute via the direct market. What are your guys' thoughts on the direct market, current state of the direct market, and all that sort of stuff?
Well, considering I'm with Image Comics and make my living off the direct market, I think it's fantastic, and I don't know what you guys are talking about. It ain't broke, and what ain't broke, we shouldn't fix.
Can I get a what, what? All right, great. Thanks
Can
a lot.
I get a what, what?
Well, I definitely have opinions on this because I do a lot of business in the direct market. And comic book shop owners have a lot going against them. First of all, there's only one place I can order comics from, and that's Diamond. Diamond is a monopoly. So they are beholden to whatever offers and discounts Diamond offers them. There's not a whole lot of competition or choice for retailers. The other thing working against retailers is that they are in a non-return business. In other words, if you are a buyer at Barnes & Noble and you buy 100 copies of PvP at large from me or from my publisher, at the end of the month, you have the right to return what you don't sell and not be stuck with the inventory. But the comic book industry is a non-return market. So whatever a comic shop owner buys, he's stuck with forever. Not only is he stuck with it, but it becomes a part of his inventory that he's going to be taxed on by the end of the year, which is why you see a lot of comic book shops now getting rid of back issues completely and only using that space for trade paperbacks because the trades sell well. And at the end of the year, all those back issues are inventory they have to pay taxes on.
Mm-hmm.
A comic book shop owner has to be very trepidatious about what it orders, especially if it's new, because if there's no guarantee it's going to sell, that's inventory he's never going to be able to sell and money he's never going to get back. So for a web cartoonist who's a little unproven, getting their book into retailers, it seems almost insurmountable to accomplish. And then on top of that, the whole comics industry seems to be in this very go comics attitude about refusing to change things. And I don't know what to do. But when you look at my business receipts from the last year, and you see that, I did twice as much selling books online myself than I did through the comic book stores, any other business would say, well, it looks like we need to expand next year online. But if you're involved in the comic book community and the direct market community, and you announce that you're going to focus online business, you're going to make exclusives for your online customers, you're going to let your online customers get books first, you will become a pariah. You will become someone who's not supporting comics. So it's a very difficult position to be in and one I'm trying to work out.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting to hear you say that. You expressed opinions that I had not thought of before. I have sort of after experimenting with the direct market with my first book, I have sort of forsaken it just in terms of the interest of making a living, because I found that the return factor on hardcover trade books, the profit margin in terms of what Diamond and then eventually what the retailer takes out. And then in terms of the fact that I am not sure that it even grows my business in terms of new readers buying Sheldon, I just decided to avoid the direct market anyway. And so far I've been happy with that decision. But I know that both Brad and you very much are into the direct market. So it's interesting to hear your opinions on it.
There's one thing. Well, I don't think you can. I think you've got to fit direct market into its appropriate place in your business. And there's something, Dave, that I know you do that I'd like to hear you talk about. And that is when you go to a comic convention, the first thing you do just before the convention starts or near the very beginning of the start of the convention is you take a bunch of Sheldon books around and you approach retailers. And I'd like to hear you talk about that.
Oh, yeah. I guess I do that. Thanks, Brad, for giving away that tip. No, you're right.
Dave, you should have just gone, I don't know anything about that. That doesn't work. That's not real.
You're right. I'll take 100 or 200 Sheldon books around, and it's really only at the big con, so I might do it at New York or I might do it at San Diego Comic-Con or something else, but I'll approach... Because I actually like retailers. It's not necessarily the retailers that I have a problem with. It's more Diamond that I have a problem with. And So I walk around at Comic-Con, and so I'll go over to, say, the five or six bigger guys that are there and sell them 20, 30, 40 copies each at a discount that we agree on. It varies in terms of the percentage that they prefer. And I do like that. I you know what it is for me? I just don't like the whole return policy, and we're going to take 60% of the profit on the book, and we're going to not necessarily promote it in any way that helps you. Like, I'd rather sell to a reader online and make a much higher percentage and capture that sale from the reader that's already on the site than have it go to a bookstore, probably have 80% of them get returned to me eventually, mm-hmm. and not necessarily find any promotional or advertising value in that book sitting on that shelf in the meantime. It's probably getting beat up over the year that it's sitting on that shelf. And I don't know that it would be a new Sheldon reader anyway. If someone buys it, it's probably an existing online reader that goes, oh, hey, look, it's in the store. And wouldn't that have been better to have sold it to them on online? You know?
Yeah, I kind of had that same experience. The first New York Comic Con we went to, a buyer from Barnes & Noble came up, picked up the first Evil Incorporated graphic novel and said, how come this is not in my stores? And I said, well, you know, give me a contract. We can get it in your stores. He gave me a copy of the contract, and it was like a short book. And like you said, everything you said was accurate. You've got the buybacks, and the 60 to 65% off the cover price is what they're buying it at. And they can send it back to you after a little while if it doesn't sell. And you're thinking, holy shnikes, how come I'm getting involved in this? But I never did get involved in it. It scared me right away. But I do have to say this. I've had really good luck with Diamond in terms of I got my books out there to comic shops. I got a really good response from it. My biggest priority then was seeing to it that I got the cost per issue of my book down when I was getting it printed. Right. But I got a pretty good shake from Diamond in general. So I haven't gotten to that point where I'm necessarily against Diamond, but as far as like getting involved in bookstores, I just can't do it. It's way too risky for an independent like ourselves.
Yeah.
Do you have a
very natural reason for wanting to get Evil Inc. into comic book shops. I mean, the audience and the potential growth for you probably is there. I would have.
Right. Whereas, yeah, it's a pretty good fit.
It's probably less likely for me to get anything, whereas you, Scott, and maybe Chris probably all benefit from a comic book store presence.
I'm trying to do that. The one that didn't interest me was getting it into bookstores. It seemed like there's no benefit to that for the reasons you already said, Brad. But comic book shops, maybe. But yours is the best of any of us, I think.
Yeah, I think Brad is a natural fit. You know, one distributor that I do like, although I haven't done anything with them recently, is Follett, who does mostly college bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
That to me seems like a worthwhile audience for my.
Wow, hey, I want to pursue that.
That Brad goes with Diamond for comic book shops. So I do Follett. The problem is, though, is that as an independent guy, all these distributors, because of the nature of their business, it's all this extra faxes and paperwork and did you get it? And here's an invoice. And oh, here's a second mailing for that other invoice. And did you send the bill? And oh, here's the check. And sometimes it's for an order of five books, and I just want to say, oh, to heck with that, I'll just sell those five books online, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe that's just me getting spoiled by truly direct sales online, but I just don't appreciate all the extra paperwork. And for Scott with Image, I'm sure they take care of all that, so you don't even have to worry about that.
They do, and I don't have to. It's good to be in comic book shops. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that at all. For me especially, the books do well in comic book shops, and they do well in bookstores. Although I would like them to be in a different section of the bookstores. But
wait, I want to go back to that though, Scott. Why is it good to be in comic book shops for you?
It doesn't cost me money, and I'm making money from it. I just think that we could all make more money from it if it wasn't so broken. And I think that I mean, for me, it's different because I have a built-in audience, so the retailers are not so afraid to take a chance on me. So I don't suffer from, for example, like the girl that does the Devil's Panties had a really hard time getting Diamond to keep her book in previews because they weren't getting enough orders from retailers for it. It was below the minimum order. And that's because retailers are afraid to take a chance on it. They don't know if it's going to sell. Retailers right. weren't as trepidatious with PvP. They most of them already read the strip. Most of them knew that I was going to do it ahead of time. And the move to Image was very public. And I'm sure their audience was coming in and asking about, or their customers were coming in and asking about it. And that's the benefit. That was my benefit, is that
but,
I had
but that's
a
what,
built-in
that's what I'm
audience.
Getting at, though. Is it a benefit to you? Like, how are you benefiting from it?
Well, I mean,
like, to me, you're making less money. You've captured hundreds of thousands of readers online. If you sell to them directly, that's a much higher profit margin than if you sell to those same exact readers, I'm assuming, in a comic book shop.
If it was an either or proposition, I would agree with you, but I can do both. It doesn't hurt for even just appearances to be able to have someone walk into a comic book shop and see that your book is there with all the other books.
Yeah, that I will agree with.
Okay. And in a bookstore. I mean, if you're not losing money for that privilege, for example, I still think Chris should solicit the Star Slip book to Diamond. Because
I did.
Okay. So
I'm just waiting to hear back.
The worst that's going to happen is they're going to come to you and say, we've got an order for 400 books. And you know, you can feel bad about that. If that was all you were doing, you should really feel bad about it, because selling 400 books is bad. That's not going to help.
Yeah.
But you're selling a lot online. And so you're going to get a check for 400 books, and people will be able to walk into a comic book shop and say, oh, wait, I've seen this online. Wow, it's in bookstores too. And it's going to raise your stock. It's going to raise your stock in their eyes publicly. And it's going to add some legitimacy to it.
I don't know why I'm being the fuss bucket about it, but I just feel like that, to me, though, is a $10,000 to $15,000 business difference. Aside from the publicity difference.
Well, Dave,
if I were to sell those books online versus selling them,
that's,
you
know, what Dave is saying.
Market,
is that I'll sell them to or I'll give them to Diamond for 60% off the cover,
right?
And I'll make, you know, $2,000 off of that or whatever. But if I sold those directly, for $20 a pop,
right?
Then I'm making so much more. But here's a question, Dave: How do you convert? Because I'm assuming that it's not entirely people who are already familiar with my strip going, oh, it's in this bookstore now. How do you convert those people to saying, look, don't buy it from the comic book shop. Buy it online. It's available online.
Well, that's what I'm – I guess that's what I'm saying is how many people – this may be my own naivete. I don't know. But how many people truly in a comic book shop pick up titles from the web that they've never heard of before? Maybe I'm being silly and there's a lot more people than I think. But I just don't know that people would be like, oh, Sheldon, never heard of that.
If you look at my numbers – if you look at my comic book sales numbers, PvP's numbers, from when I started in 2003 to now, you will see the steady decline of people that had never heard of it, discovering it in the comic book shop, and then slowly replacing reading it in the shop to reading it online.
Go ahead.
No, Brad, you go. You have a better point, I'm sure.
I'm going to piggyback on that. In other words, what Scott is saying, that people discovered him in the comic shop and then became web readers, right?
Right, and now they don't pick up necessarily the monthlies anymore.
So
you're saying that's almost advertising.
Dave, answer that question for yourself. How many people are going to pick up Sheldon having never read it before and buy the book? You know the answer to that question because I've stood beside you at comic conventions. How many people buy your book having never read it before?
A lot.
Yeah, and the same thing is going to happen at a comic shop.
Maybe I'm just not seeing this. I don't, and I'm totally willing to admit that.
You know what the thing is?
My business sense tells me, though, the profit margin is so much higher online that it's worth keeping it online.
David, think about it this way. Think about it as advertising that you're being paid for.
It's a subsidized advertising. I got you.
Okay, so... You know, and this is going to be a lot better as time goes on, because more comic book shops are realizing that if they want to survive, they have to stop looking like some pedophile's basement, and they need to start looking more like clean, fun, family-friendly bookstores.
That's actually good for any business,
and,
really.
Yeah, exactly. And more and more of them, are getting rid of their nerd-centric sections, which are back issues. And back issues are great. If finding a store that has everything you want back issue-wise is awesome, but that's a customer base of, I hope someone comes in today looking for Mr. Miracle number 5, the first appearance of Granny Goodness, because that's the only way I'm going to sell that book. But if you took all those racks and racks of back issues and got rid of them and replaced them with book racks that you could display trades on, cover out, not spine out, all of a sudden, you're making a lot of money, and a lot of stores are discovering this. I went to a comic book store in Austin called the Dragon's Lair, and I was like, wow, why don't we have bookstores like this in Dallas? And I was like, this is where did you get this, and where did you see this? And I went back to Zeus, who displays their comics, their trade, Spine Out, and they had all the same books, but I just never noticed them because I never saw the cover.
Right.
But Dragon's Lair has all their books cover out, and... You know, so what I'm saying is that's going to change more and more. And so someone's going to walk through a bookstore with their kids, and a little kid's going to see, you know, Arthur on a cover and get excited about the duck and want to pick it up.
Yeah.
Maybe it's right.
And my business instincts might have failed me on this. I for some reason, I've just decided that it's not worth it for the direct market. But maybe I'll rethink it. I don't know.
You're right, Dave. If you just compare the numbers of what you'll make, then you're right. But what I'm saying to you is, if you can take it for what I'm saying is, if you submitted Sheldon to Diamond, I think they would come back to you and say, "All right, we'd like to put this in previews." And then 2 months later, be 4 months later, because you'll give them the solicitation that they're going to put in a catalog that's 2 months away. Then the orders will come in 1 month later. So it's almost 3 months later. They'll say, "We received from retailers 300 orders for your book. So you will need to send us 300 books, and we'll pay you 60% of the cover price for it, and you'll get a check." And so it's 300 books. But those books are then going to be distributed out to bookstores across the nation for people to walk in and see it.
It's kind of an irony here in that I hear what you're saying, Dave. You should be able to convert all those people, or a good chunk of them, who are buying Sheldon in the bookstores. You should be able to convert those into web purchases. But the bottom line is that when people walk into a comic store or a comic convention, in the back of their mind somewhere is that they're going to be opening their wallet at some point during that experience. They're coming in to buy. Very few people just come in to browse. They're going to pick something up. That's not the case on your website. On your website, you've got to somehow convert them into buying mode. They're there to be entertained, maybe in a passive way, or maybe if they participate on the forums, a certain degree of activity. But they're not coming. They don't hit Sheldon.com every morning with a thought, "What can I buy today?"
Yeah.
So you've got to take advantage. I like I said in the very beginning, I think you've got to put it in its appropriate place in your business plan.
And also,
not shirk it completely, but, you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
Maybe this sounds a little duplicitous, or maybe it sounds a little fake, and that's what Dave's having the problem with. And maybe I'm not as good of a person for doing it. But, for example, Image really wanted to sell plushes through the bookstore chains. And Diamond's, if you think Diamond's cut on books are bad, wait till you see their cuts on toys. And so, of course, because their Image, they were like, "Nah, let's do the plushes, but the same percentage cut." And Diamond's like, "All right." Now, maybe 200, 300 plushes, 400 plushes went out. And I definitely make more money selling them online. But most of those plushes, as bad as it is for the retailer, most of them just end up as decoration for the store.
Right.
So now you're at a convention and someone walks up and they come by the plush and they go, "Oh, what is this? I saw this at my comic book shop. Is this you?" Because now there's a change of perception. Where before you're just a guy at a con that they see at every con they go to trying to sell those plushes that he's never going to move. But now suddenly, because the comic book shop owner has put one of the plushes on his counter as decoration
and validation,
now you are a part of comics in their brain. "Oh, I saw this at my shop," or "Oh, I saw this at my gaming shop when I went to play Magic last week," or "Oh, my kid has one of the," you know, there's a change in perception. And it's just like when Wizard did an article on PvP. Nothing changed about PvP. It's not like people started reading it because suddenly I improved it. It's just because everyone went, "Oh, Wizard likes this. Well, maybe I should consider it." you know? And it's just,
yeah. And I do completely admit too that from an industry perspective, I've completely removed myself from a lot of, what's the best way to say it? Industry consideration by not doing anything in stores anymore. You know, I'll never be nominated for certain types of awards. I'll never be considered for certain types of judging situations because I'm just not involved in the distribution side of things. And I think that makes a big difference industry wide. So I'm totally willing to admit that from a advertising and an industry perspective, walking away from the direct market hurts you. But I just feel like the cost benefit analysis of it doesn't weigh out in terms of making a living from comics.
I think you're safe, Dave, if you don't do what I did and start to buy into the hype. For example, it's great if someone walks into a store and sees a plush and automatically says, "Oh, that plush is in this comic book shop, so whatever that property is, that's comics. That's as important as Batman."
Right.
Right? And that perception's there. But when all that starts to add up and you start to see that that's the perception that's growing about your work, you can't then stop doing your what you might consider grassroots stuff to bring in money. Because that stuff doesn't bring in money. I mean, it's like look at the Eisner. I mean, the Eisner has not sold any books for me. But me doing sketches on books for free sold books.
Right, right.
But if you put those two together, that's pretty powerful.
Right, that's a good combo.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. I'm totally willing to admit that I have removed myself from ever possibly being considered for an Eisner and stuff like that.
Don't think you should do that. I don't think you should. There's no reason why I got nominated for an Eisner, but I did.
No, I'm saying not being involved in the direct market removes you from an industry feeling and an industry camaraderie and an industry consideration, you know?
Yes, and I don't think that's bad to foster, Dave, but just the trick is not to then go, well, I've got an Eisner and people know me and people associate me with comics and all these people that I grew up admiring consider me a colleague, so I've made it. And now I can just sit back and wait for shit to sell. All
right,
the month has ended. What did I sell? Nothing, but I have an Eisner, and I was a wizard.
But I have an Eisner.
Mike Waringo calls me on the weekends. What? Make books sell. Why? And meanwhile, Dave's over there counting money. I'm in the money. Chinking, I sell my books online, and I've got lots of money.
Honey, please. Love you. Throw a couple more 20s on the fire, won't you?
Well, you know what? And here's another way that I always looked at it, and let me try to phrase it in a different way, is that the guy that goes into a comic book shop, and let's be honest, it's probably a guy. He's probably somewhere between 20 and 55, right? I mean, that's the average comic book guy.
That's what we're trying to break right now, but
yes. Very few kids anymore, very few women, very few broader than your average comic book guy, goes into a comic book shop. The odds are that same guy spends a fair amount of time online, and I'm not going to make any sort of comments about that guy's life, but let's be honest, he's probably going to spend a fair amount of time online. I'm probably going to have just as much a chance of capturing him somehow online through just doing online promotions and ventures and marketing as I would by getting that book in the store. So I just feel in the longer term, it's smarter for me to try to capture him online where I can be bookmarked very quickly than to try to get into a bookstore, make less money and capture the same audience that I would online, you know.
You're right.
Yeah.
So I don't know, and maybe that's me just being cynical, but I, you know what, too, direct market. Whenever I deal with Diamond, I always kind of feel like a 16-year-old girl walking into a room of teensters, you know. It's like I always kind of feel like they're treating me like, "Hey, pretty, don't worry, we're gonna take care of you. Everything's gonna be fine. We're Diamond. Hey, you look good. You look
bad, Diamond."
This might be me being naive, but I've had a really good experience with Diamond so far. Now they haven't.
16-year-old girl, Brad.
No, but I've been, every time I've come to a comic convention, several times, either the rep or my actual rep has come up and you know, he knows who I am and they make sure, you know, hey, they know what I'm doing and they take, I mean, I don't want to be a Diamond cheerleader, but so far I haven't had that experience.
Well, good. No, that's good. That's good to hear that counterpoint. I think that's good.
Huh. But I do want to say this, as long as, because we are talking to people in a lot of respects that are a little bit earlier in their progression than we are. So I want to I do want to bring this up about that. We had been talking about some print-on-demand issues like Lulu and some of the other groups that do print-on-demand. And you're getting to this point that you decide you are going to take the leap to the direct sales market. And so you think, okay, and this is exactly what happened to me. You know that if you buy a substantial number of books from Lulu, they will give you a cost break. So I say to myself, maybe if I sell 300, 500 books, I can get that cost per book down to, you know, $3.50, $4 a book. And then you get your order from Diamond. And let's say you sold 400 books and you're thinking, okay, I got a cost per book for $4. Well, that's not exactly right, because you've got to ship 44 of those books to Tennessee, and you've got to ship 150 of those books to Los Angeles. And now you're paying almost, you know, you're $5 or $6 per book to get these things done if you want to have them shipped directly, or you've got to buy all 300 for your at your discount, pay to have them shipped to you, and then pay to have them shipped out. So the moral of the story here, and I had to learn this one the hard way, by the time you're getting ready to go through a distribution like Diamond, you've got to be printing these things up at 3,000, 4,000 at a clip, or, you know, in the thousands, I should say, you know, 1,000, 2,000 from a printer, be able to store them like we were talking a couple podcasts ago, and then go to Diamond, put your solicit out, hope for the best, and send them from there.
Right. And when you're doing all the sending, because you do have to send it to Diamond's different distribution centers. There's one, in, like you said, Brad, one in California, one somewhere down in Kentucky or Tennessee or whatever, and then like one on the East Coast. And when you're sending them all separately, which is annoying in and of itself, then you also, there's all this weird sort of fulfillment paperwork that's like, can only be printed on 8.5 by 11 cream vellum paper using a 12-point font. You have to use this exact text. And you're like, what is all this hassle? I'm making $1 a book on this.
Right. And they just came out with a new thing that you've got to have your UPC label or your, the barcode printed and put affixed somewhere on the outside of the box. They just came out with that a few weeks ago. So it is a good degree of complication trying to get all that stuff done as an independent.
Yeah. And I think there's three good different opinions on this in terms of how to do it. And that's probably the safest way to present it, is that it's going to work differently for different businesses. And depending on yours, evaluate the facts of it. And if you think it can work for your business, then by all means, it's a tried and true method, and direct market can definitely be made to work.
Yes.
So that's probably a fair place to leave that, I think.
Just be realistic about it. It is what it is.
We spent a lot of time on that. Maybe we should move on and take a look at the forums and see if there are other questions that we can come back and address on this topic in the future.
Yeah, that's good. Anybody have a question you want to go with, or shall I read the next one?
Well, you better read the next one, because Chris's computer isn't booting up. Hey, is there a CD in this thing? Is that maybe holding it up? Is it trying to boot off that CD?
Why would it try to boot off that one?
I don't know.
But there is one in there.
What exactly did you do?
Restarted it.
I mean, what did you install? What was the up? You did the software update.
It was a firmware update.
And let me ask you a question. Was this one of those things where the update installed 2 days ago and you just didn't want to reboot your computer and it's been sitting there?
No, I rebooted it right away.
Oh.
Dad.
Well, you did that before,
Dad.
Not with a firmware update.
Does anybody know how to eject a disk out of an iMac?
I know how to do it from the terminal.
Out of an iMac. Does it have one of those? A lot of times they've got like a little pinhole you can take and dismantle a paperclip and stick it in there. Does it have one of those?
No, the new iMacs don't have that.
Yeah, my old iMac I know doesn't.
Do you have main menu install? You can force an ejection, I think.
It won't boot at all.
It's not even booting.
It does the home and comes up, and I can't get an Apple.
Oh no, your memory's loose then.
Really? Dave, your iMac is in more trouble than anybody's.
What is that about?
If it goes bong and then it doesn't go anywhere, somehow your memory got jarred loose, I think.
Weird.
I trust that we're going to be editing this part out.
No, we can edit this part out.
It's an important part.
We always say we're going to edit stuff out, and then I notice it's always in the podcast.
Now, the important thing to learn is don't buy Macs. They're cool and all.
Listen, it's an important thing to learn about webcomics, that these things happen.
Yes.
with Macintosh computer.
To Chris's computer.
Do you want me to smack it? Do you want me to hit it?
Yeah, just give it
jar
a little,
some memory back.
I want you to rub it. See if the genie comes out.
I am not touching that.
Let's go to the mailbox.
I'm going to read my email while you guys are fiddling.
No, okay.
No, keep going. Keep going. Let's keep going.
I'm making a request for an Australian accent for the next mailbox item, please.
Let's switch back.
I can't do Australian. Come on, Brad. Give me a second one. I can't do Australian very well.
You get Australian?
I always have Cockney.
How about the 1940s newscaster?
All right. All right. Next question. Here we go. It's on character evolution. Okay, this is from Brandon Peake. The question is, hey, guys, love the podcast. Great stuff, and I'll be buying a copy of the book as soon as it hits stands. I was wondering if you could talk about character evolution, how repeatedly drawing the same characters over and over again will cause them to gradually change in appearance. You see the same thing in mainstream cartooning as the artist develops his or her drawing style. Even look at the evolution of Calvin and Hobbes over the years. On the flip side, what about Chris and those who use Flash or Illustrator or vector programs, doing more digital duplicating than repetitive drawing? Do you find that relying on programs and templates prevents character style evolution, or is it a stellar time saver that allows you to do more time for other ventures?
Let me answer
like
that
a
one.
Pro-con situation. Love to hear everyone's thoughts.
Let me answer that one. Both are yes. It is a great time saver, and it is a roadblock to advancing your drawing ability. I'm using the same sprites for Starship Crisis that I started with. Not that I would have evolved much, because I haven't evolved a lot in the last 6-7 years. But I would probably be drawing more fluidly. I would probably be making character design changes over time, like you've seen in any other strip. So I don't know. And one of the things I don't really get an opportunity to draw the characters that often. But when I started doing the sketches in the artist edition of the Starship book, I kind of felt hamstrung. I'm like, well, I kind of want to change this. I kind of want to draw it differently. But now I'm thinking, but that's not what the characters look like on the site that I'm still the way I'm still quote unquote drawing them. So I think it is, if you use it to save time, then that's what you should use it for. Or maybe reevaluate the sprites you're using every once in a while. Because I would love to have had my art style jump ahead 2 years. But that wouldn't have happened, or that doesn't happen this way. That would happen if I drew it every day, as much time as that would take.
Yeah, you're doing almost doing yourself a disservice by not drawing by hand something.
Yeah.
Because you don't, that's what was holding back PvP's art, was I had these templates that I would trace, because what was happening for me was, I was discovering if I didn't use these templates, I would go for a week or a month and realize that I was running out of room for my words. It's because every time I drew them a little bit bigger, you know?
Yeah.
And then people would, you know, kind of not work within proportions of each other. Like I'd realize in this strip, God, Brent is way too big compared to Skull.
Right.
So I started drawing on top of, I had vellum, I draw on vellum on top of a sheet of a character, essentially a character sheet. And that way, Brent was always the same height and Skull is always the same height. But what was happening was I was tracing more than I realized and only changing what had to be changed for the panel.
Yeah.
And so now, especially, and I'm on the Wacom, I do very, very loose sketches so that I have just the same height. Everyone's the same height and width. But most of the drawing is done on the fly, and that's allowed for these wonderful happy accents to happen. And then you say, oh, wow, I really like the way I drew Brent's mouth in that panel. I'm going to do that again, you know, and then you build from that. So,
yeah.
And that actually leads me right into a pro tip that I've been trying to get to for the last few podcasts.
Wait, a pro tip, Brad?
It is a pro tip.
Is it a pro tip that we can use?
Pro tip, Brad Wiggle.
I love the little chuckle in there. Here's my pro tip. You know in the old movies where they round up all the usual suspects and they bring them in for the police lineup and they stand everybody up in front of that board that has all feet and half feet marked off against it?
Right.
So you can tell how tall they are. This guy is 5'2". This guy's 5'1". when you take some time sometime this week and draw all of your characters in front of one of those police lineups, so you can and really think about okay, is this character more of a 5'4" or a 5'6" person, and is he a little bit taller than the next guy? Draw everybody right down the line where they fall on that police lineup. Post it above your drawing board or above your workstation, and then just use that as a general guide as you're drawing. And you can kind of see, okay, I've got Bob and Ted in this comic. Bob's nose kind of comes up to Ted's shoulder. Doesn't matter if you're drawing them full form or not in the panel, as long as you're kind of lining up the nose to the shoulder, you know that you've got their proportions just about right.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good tip. You know what, too, is that height differentials can also make for comedy, as it does in natural life, you know? So
mm-hmm.
consider that when you're designing characters. Is that the short guy with a lot of power or a Napoleonic complex makes for a funny kind of character to a tall, thin guy is, shy and withholding, basically. Or vice versa. It's a definitely a different character if it's a tall, huge guy that has a megalomania. So that can a height difference can make for an interesting character touch.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because you're going to have it just the gesture effect of looking up and looking down, looking down on someone or shouting from below. It always kind of ramp up that drama that you're going to be putting into your illustration.
Right. But I'd like to touch, if I can go back to the question about character evolution, is that I, and maybe Chris would feel this way too, is that when I look at early Sheldons or even Sheldons from maybe, gosh, I don't know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, my stomach churned because I just don't like the drawing style. And the slow natural evolution of a character is actually the slow natural evolution of your artistic ability. And you get better. If you're drawing 2 hours a day for 8 years, you're not the same cartoonist that you were 8 years ago. You're a far, far better cartoonist in terms of perspective, line quality, color influence, and all that sort of stuff. And if I wasn't doing that every day, I would still be drawing the same sprited Arthur and Sheldon and Gramp every day, and I wouldn't even notice it. But looking back on it now, I would feel unfortunate if I was still stuck with the same characters that I started drawing 8 years ago or 9 years ago, whatever it was.
So would we all, Dave.
I end up saying this at least once, if not several times, during a comic convention to somebody who's talking about doing their own comic, and that is, it's impossible to get worse at something you do every day. You know, if you're doing it every day, you can't. What?
I could make an argument against that.
Seriously?
No, come on, Brad's right about that.
That's
a truism.
Listen, the reason why is because,
unless you're cheating.
No, but what I'm trying to tell you is that make sure you're doing the right thing every day, because if you keep,
you know what I mean. Yeah.
From personal experience, I can tell you that eating whatever I wanted every day did not make me get better.
But it made you more efficient.
It made me a more efficient eater.
Exactly.
It got me out of a lot of yard work. But
but we've seen that too.
I go back.
But
I do think that in something like this, that if you do it every day, you're going to find better ways to do things. You're going to naturally improve.
No, yeah. I agree with that.
Well, you know what, too, is that what's that old quote of first you get good, then you get fast, then you get good fast? Have you guys ever heard that?
Yeah.
No. But I like it.
I think it's true, though, because first I learned to draw, I'm still learning to draw. But first I sort of got good at drawing my characters. Then I got fast at drawing my characters. And then you get good fast. And I think if Chris and I were to start a strip from complete scratch side by side, I would only be a few minutes behind Chris in terms of finishing up a hand-drawn versus his vector art now, you know?
That's probable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on what the strip is, but yeah. I mean, then you end up having to make the choice, and I never make this choice because I always just draw it because I know it's bad to do, where you're like, oh, I've got a scene in mind, but I've got only these sprites, so maybe I'll rework the joke so it works with them standing there.
Oh, yeah.
That is awful to do.
Right. And there's also the I think Scott hit on a note too that's nice, which is with hand drawing, there's a lot of happy accidents that maybe turn into a complete character evolution.
Yeah.
And not even character evolution. Sometimes my pen will slip or a brush will make a darker mark. Like today's strip, I was drawing a tree with a Japanese brush, and the thing was really slipping and I was having trouble controlling it, but it ended up making a better looking tree. And mm-hmm. I realized that that's why Watterson would use a brush to do art or to do nature, is because a brush creates a natural looking feel that a pen doesn't do with a straight line. So accidents can sometimes create a happy little moment in a comic strip. Happy little trees. ridiculous. But there was another point that I was going to make, and it was stellar. Oh, it involved dragons. What was it?
That they're dangerous.
I don't remember what it was.
Well, thanks for holding up the show. You could have made something up.
All right, who's got the next question? Shall we go on? Or did everybody talk about that one, by the way? Am I skipping over somebody?
I don't know. I think we're good on that. I think where the question is it better to draw more often than not? Yeah, that's the quick answer.
What I'm saying is that Chris and I were talking about this morning reading the webcomics book in our toilet. Just because you've come up with a process to make your comic doesn't mean it's necessarily a good process. And I don't know that repeating that is smart. Coming from a guy who was using a process for years that I think was holding him back. Dave, you were saying you hate going back to your earlier Sheldon stuff because it makes you cringe.
Yeah.
How do you feel about looking stuff from last year? Are you okay with it?
That tends to not be enough time where I mind it. Like, my style probably didn't evolve all that much as an account.
I have trouble looking at stuff at the beginning of this year. I really feel like I've jumped a lot this year.
I hate
well,
my work from 6 months ago.
Well, sometimes you do that, though. You make that quantum leap, you know?
But getting this Wacom tablet changed everything for me. And that could have happened a lot sooner. I could be farther ahead. Good pro tip.
It's time for another pro tip from Brad Wigwam.
No, that was the start. You played the start at the end and the end of the start.
I did it wrong.
You gotta do it backwards.
Damn it. I forgot that I had Dave's laugh built into that one. Hey, I would like to... Actually, I do have a pro tip.
Man.
All right, I'll do the...
It's time for another pro tip from Scott Kerr.
I'll do it right this time.
It's time for another pro tip from Scott Kurtz.
There you go.
We were discussing a couple weeks ago the issue of copywriting your work and exactly what you need to do. And I got an email from somebody who was pretty adamant that my dismissal of what I call the poor man's copyright was a little quick and judgmental, that it's a very valid way of copywriting your work. So I decided that I was going to still not believe that guy and find out the real way to copyright your work. And oh my God, it could not be simpler. Now, this is copyright. This is not trademark. The law is that once you create something, the moment you create it, you own the copyright to it. And at that point, all you have to do is prove that you created it. So here's what you do. For cartoonists, I looked it up, and you have to fill out a form for visual artworks, okay? So step one is to make sure that your work is a visual arts work, that those are works that are pictorial, graphic, or sculptural. And then it said, here are examples of visual arts. If you click on the link, it lists in here, and I was very excited. Advertisements, artificial flowers and plants, artwork applied to clothing, blah, 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 blah. Cartoons, comic strips.
It's right in there.
It's right in there. So
wait, so you're saying it's not artificial flowers and plants?
Though. No, but according to the Library of Congress, comic strips and cartoons are right there next to dolls and artificial flowers. But anyway, so here's step two. Now that you've confirmed that your work is visual arts, which we have, step two is you get an envelope. You complete form VA, which you can print right off of the Library of Congress website. Send in a payment of $45, a check made out to Register of Copyrights, and you send a non-returnable copy of your material, all you got to do is stick your book in there or print out, a collection of 30 strips and staple them together. And then you send the package to the Library of Congress over on Independence Avenue in Washington, D.C., and your registration is effective the day they get it, and you will receive a certificate. That's it. And then you
That's pretty easy.
That is really easy. I did not think it would be that easy or that cheap. Print
and
a form.
I have one more thing to add about the poor man's copyright that struck me as I was thinking about it later. It only works once.
How do you mean? Oh.
If you're putting all this stuff in an envelope and you have to prove your copyright, you might be able to pull it off and prove it that time, but what happens a week later when you've got to prove your copyright again?
I gotcha.
Well, I would assume that if you're pulling it out, it's in a court or legal setting. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you'd have the court record to point back at. It's still as easy as what Scott was just talking about. I think that's definitely the better option.
So my question to Chris is, Chris, do we have a place on Webcomics Weekly that I could post a show note? Because this website right here, this page I have. There's actually another button you can click here specifically for comic strips, and it has some deposit requirements depending on whether your work has been published or not. And I don't know if it's worthwhile to speak
out
loud.
You know what, Scott? Someone on the forums has already started kindly putting together all the links that different shows.
Okay,
have,
so go if you want to get the links. I'll make a post in the Webcomics Weekly forums. Do we have those?
We don't have. Oh yeah, we do. We do.
We do, right?
Yeah, you can post it in there.
Oh, over at HalfPixel?
At halfpixel.com.
Okay. So I'm going to make a post there. There you go. Copyright your stuff, guys. Don't let it be hanging out there. Don't let
anybody boom copyright.
Oh. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
It's
copyright.
You nailed the post on that one.
Pro tip, Red Wing, copyright.
Okay, next mailbag.
All right.
All right, someone give me a voice to do.
How about a
1940s news broadcaster?
1940s news broadcaster. Okay, this is from Pat Race at acrobotics.com. I've been putting high-resolution images on my site in case people want to print something off for themselves. I thought that if I had a fan with enough interest to actually print off a page and hang it up, it would be nice to have something that wasn't all pixelated. Is this a huge mistake? Do other artists do it? That's the end of the question.
Hey, from now on, I'll just do this.
End of question.
Well, I'm going to lead off on that. I think that's a bad idea. I think that that's something that you could easily actually bring a little bit of money into your site by charging a very nominal and understandable fee for. I don't like the idea of giving high res away for very much of anything unless you can show that you're getting something from it. Is that me being too much of a hard-nosed businessman? I don't know. I'm hearing crickets over there.
No, I agree with you, Brad.
Because I talk too much, but I was in complete agreement with you, Brad. I think it's one of those what do they call it when you hold the card close to your chest? When it's something of your work in high res, something of value, and you don't want to be giving that away willy-nilly.
Yeah,
right.
Because when folks start having access to all your high res files, it's sort of like getting the keys to the bank. Or some other metaphor that's better than the one I just used. So by all means, let them distribute your 72 DPI comic. You can let people take it. You can let people put it on whatever you want. You're comfortable letting them put it on. Just make sure you have that copyright notice and the URL on the strip itself with that 72 DPI file. But I would avoid, as Brad said, giving away the high-res file.
Yeah, that's the opposite of what everybody's doing right now. Everyone's trying to figure out how not to have their comics stolen, I guess.
But why would the original question poser even, what would be the value of doing that?
He said he wanted for readers that had enough interest to print it off and hang it up, that it would be nice to have something that wasn't all pixelated.
Well, then you print it and you sell them a print.
Hey, well, there's a psychological thing that we've got to get into there that feeds into a whole bigger topic, and that is, read that sentence again. If a fan likes it enough.
My thought was that if I had a fan with enough interest to actually print off a page and hang it up, it would be nice for them to have something that wasn't all pixelated.
Okay, this is where we as cartoonists, and it applies to every last one of us, need to stop being so needy and stop being so unsure of our work. Your work has value, and there is nothing that should be so hard to believe as if a fan likes it enough to actually, of course somebody out there is going to like it enough to print it out. Your work has value, and until we get rid of these feelings of insecurity and neediness as cartoonists, we're not only going to lose money on this sort of thing, but we're going to fall for every business guy that comes down the line that says, oh, I couldn't possibly pay you to run your cartoon in my magazine, but think of the exposure you'll get. You should do this for all the exposure you'll get. And constantly, right on down the line, cartoonists are getting screwed by these kind of deals because they think, oh, yeah, well, my work maybe isn't good enough to get paid for, and this guy is giving me exposure, and we got to stop that.
Yeah. Not only that, as much as it pains me to admit it's true, there is a mental perception about things given away for free. When I had the bright idea to offer my comic strip for free to major newspapers, most of the syndicated cartoonists' response was, don't devalue our work. And also it was, no one's going to want it. If it's free, they're not going to want it. And that was foreign to me. What are you talking about? If it's free, they'll want it more. But oh my God, it's true. It was free. I was offered to them for free, and their thought was, well, if he's giving it away for free, it can't be worth anything.
Well, and that leads to a more complex conversation too, because I know both Dave and I are giving away our comics to college newspapers for free, but that's why I specifically said, I don't do it unless you're getting something for it.
And I think that's different.
I think you can make the argument that you're getting a good ad in a college newspaper to a desirable demographic. But what that isn't to discount what you said. I think there's a lot of to be gained from what you were talking about with the daily newspaper thing.
I think I would turn around and
support that.
I think colleges are
actually I think it's an extension of what Scott was saying. There's a perceived value situation when people go to buy either a book or an original art or any sort of comic related property, which is that I could charge $2 for my Sheldon books. But then people would go, well, wait a minute, why is this only worth $2? And I might actually sell less of them than if I charge what the book is worth.
Right.
You know, there's that's definitely true with original art. It's true with dealing with editors, is that there are values for things in life, and what we do has value. It has great value. And just because per se the American market considers it to be a work of children, for children, and by children, doesn't mean that it's not an artistic creation and worthy of payment. And why am I talking in all high-mindedness? But anyway.
and what we create is something of immense value to society.
But also,
I think it's because this is something we've all dealt with. We've all been in a situation where somebody looked across the table at us and said, but think of the exposure you're going to get. I mean, that idea went right out the window with the Hully Gully at this point. We've got the internet. I've got all the exposure I need. You know, I couldn't possibly imagine getting more exposure right now. It's just up to me to maximize it. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But we've all been there, and I think that's why this kind of stirs a certain amount of passion in us, is that we've all seen, and I know I've got taken on this deal as much as anybody else has.
Right.
Yeah.
I also think it's different to give your stuff away to colleges because college, when you give something away to an educational institution, the colleges are looking for that. They're not, they don't have the money to spend. I think it's okay to do
that. Now you're a humanitarian.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is that a college can probably pay on average, what, $5 a cartoon? Is that gonna pay, you know, Brad's milk bill this month? Probably not, you know, so.
Not the way I drink milk.
I don't know why I drink milk, anyway.
No, but I I agree. I think what I distinctly remember when I heard about Scott's idea to give his trip away to newspapers for free, I remember emailing him saying, that's a great idea. That's brilliant. That's going to work perfectly. And I don't think that I would be as much of a cheerleader for that idea anymore, especially not hearing what Scott had to say about it.
But guess who still wants – guess who showed no interest? The major papers. Guess who's still showing interest in wanting my strips for free? College papers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's a different mentality for some reason for the college papers.
Well, and there's also something a little bit deeper
broke.
Going on with the newspaper editors, I think, and that is that they have a very little trust for anything that doesn't have a syndicate behind it.
Right.
When they're talking about having Scott Kurtz email them high-res strips every week for the comic, they can't fathom that. They can't imagine that you're actually going to do that. They need that corporate presence behind it, ensuring that you're going to follow up on what you're promising. You know what I mean?
That's very much true.
The bottom line there is that most newspaper editors, like every sort of human being, are essentially lazy, and they don't want to have to make sure that Scott, even though Scott's a consummate professional, they don't want to have to follow up with making sure he's meeting his deadlines. They want a syndicate to be doing that. And in their mind, that's the purpose of a syndicate system, is to make sure that their extra content, which they would consider to be columns and cartoons, just shows up in an inbox and they don't even have to think about it. You know, it's already kind of pre-edited, it's pre-vetted, and they can just slap it onto a page.
Well, and it's also even going deeper than that. This is something that they didn't do last year, which is buy a comic directly from a cartoonist without the syndicate involved. They didn't do that last year. They didn't do it the year before. Therefore, doing something new is way too terrifying for somebody who could end up getting called on the carpet for making the bad decision.
Right, 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 right. Very true. Yeah, and newspapers especially suffer from that, but that's a whole separate topic.
Mm. Well, hey, if I add up the little audio file times here, we're at 26 minutes and 36 minutes.
Wow, we're over an hour.
So,
we'd like to talk.
Do you want to... Do you want to save the rest for our next show for next week?
Let's do that. It. I'm done.
Well, let's end this podcast with a puppy's kiss and go our separate ways. I just love saying puppy's kiss.
Puppy's kiss.
Obviously.
The phrase that I stuck with me was from last week or 2 weeks ago when Chris was like, I just want to give everybody a piece of candy and a hug. And what did you say?
Is it a piece of candy and a kiss?
Piece of candy and a kiss.
Who wants the outro?
Take us home, somebody.
Brad, you do it.
You've been listening to Webcomics Weekly. Sitting across from me, way across, over on the left-hand coast, is Dave Kellett from SheldonComics.com. Over in Texas is my good friend, Chris Straub. Every day he brings you Starslip Crisis at www.starslip.com. And sitting across from him, the man, the myth, the legend, Scott Kurtz. He's over at PvP, Player versus Player. That's www.pvponline.com. Sheldon, I forgot to give the URL. It's Sheldon Comics. Oh, I did do the URL. Oh, I screwed that up.
We're going to run out of music.
Oh, man. I was going so smooth.
I'll fix this in post.
No,
Brad.
You won't. No, you won't.
Quick show of hands. Brad never gets to do the outro again.
And I'm Brad Geiger. This will be the last time you hear my voice. That was nice while it lasted, everybody. I'm Incorporated at evil-comics.com.
Comics?
No, it's evil-comics.
It's your own URL.
Oh. And comic is spelled comic.
evil-comix.
Brad, are you distracted? Are you like making a sandwich or...
All right.